Hi, Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you are about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Last fall, right around Thanksgiving, a terrible act of violence occurred in Burlington. Three young men of Palestinian descent were shot while out on a walk together. All three survived. One, Hisham Awartani, suffered a spinal cord injury. He's now paralyzed from the waist down and needs a wheelchair. Hisham and his friends were in town to visit his extended family. His parents live in Ramallah in the West Bank and are experiencing a whole other type of violence due to the war between Israel and Hamas. After the shooting, his parents flew from Ramallah to Burlington to be with their son. His mother, Elizabeth Price, joined me on Vermont Edition soon after. Since then, her family has been on a journey to support their son as he returns to college and adapt to a new life with a wheelchair. They've also been working to adapt her brother's Burlington home so it can remain a home base for Hisham. Today, how people adapt their lives after a major injury and the unique challenges of doing this in Vermont. We are joined first today by Elizabeth Price, the mother of Hisham Awartani. Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming back to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you for having me.
And today, our phone lines are not open, but if you have a message to share with Elizabeth or if her family story brings up something for you, you can email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So, Elizabeth, you and I last spoke in December. It was just a few weeks after your son was injured. How is he doing now?
He's doing amazing. He's a remarkable young man, really. So less than a year since he was injured, he is back at school full time. This is his second semester since he was shot. He's doing three classes. He has bought a car, which has been adapted, and he's learned how to drive the adapted car. And now he is fully independent and driving himself to his daily rehab. So I'm about to go back to Palestine, and my husband and I have been taking turns being here and being his chauffeur and his general, you know, factotum. And he's now very happy to be living life on his own, and we're returning to our life, knowing that he is independent now.
So he's back at school. What is he studying?
Well, he is doing a double degree, a BSc in math and a BA in archaeology. So right now he's doing only archaeology courses because he added that quite late. So he's catching up on that and he's really enjoying that.
That's amazing. And how are the other young men, his two friends, doing?
It's been tough. Each of them have experienced in a very different way. They had different injuries. They'd have had different experiences. You know, one young man was shot and had a very painful chest wound. Another man was also shot, but also had the added trauma of having, he was able to leave the scene and then thought that his friends were dead for 45 minutes. So each of the boys has had a trauma that they didn't deserve. And then on top of that, they were experiencing the trauma of their home country being demolished in Gaza and in the West Bank, and then living here and trying to advocate for Palestine in a way that is, you know, as your news item just said, has been made controversial. Human rights for Palestinians has been made controversial. So I think they are all holding their heads up and then continuing going, but this is a burden on their shoulders that is undeserved.
Yeah. What remarkable young men. And when Hisham was shot, as we mentioned earlier, you and your husband flew right over from your home in the West Bank, and the war in that region continues to this day. I've thought often since we first spoke, Elizabeth, about your family who's been back there, and I'm wondering how they are doing. I can't imagine balancing these two very different but very intense tragedies.
Yes, I mean, I think my family in Palestine can't wait to see Hisham and hold him because they have had to go through this experience without being able to be with him at all. But the life in Palestine right now, I mean, obviously in Gaza, it's a genocidal war zone. In the West Bank, there's a lot of ethnic cleansing going on. My husband's family live very close to Tul Kerem, which is where one of the sites where Gaza, the Israeli army has been going in and devastating personal and public infrastructure over and over again. And I think that the economy is destroyed. School is difficult. Health services are difficult. The Israeli government has confiscated for 2 years 80% of the Palestinian government income, so they haven't paid full wages to civil servants. Life in Palestine right now is one of anticipation of the worst and the knowledge that the worst can happen and nothing will stop it. So it's a terrifying and tragic time to be a Palestinian, particularly living in Gaza or the West Bank. Mm.
And I remember, Elizabeth, when we first spoke, how you and your entire family were very thankful for the medical care that Hisham was able to receive at the University of Vermont Medical Center, and contrasting that with the situation in your home region. And I also remember when we first spoke, you said that a number of local visitors came to UVM to meet with Hisham and with you provide comfort, speak with him, and sometimes even give a little glimpse into what his future might be like. And one of those visitors was Kelly Brush, who suffered mm-hmm. a spinal cord mm-hmm. injury while skiing at Middlebury College. She now uses a wheelchair, and she is mm-hmm. an advocate for people with similar injuries, as well as an accomplished athlete. I'm curious what advice she gave you, and whether any of it has stuck with you and with Hisham to this day.
Kelly Brush's visit was instrumental, and I think people who have been paralyzed, who have spinal cord injuries, and who come to hospitals to meet the family and the patients or those with injuries are doing just wonderful work. I mean, just seeing in this moment where we were still grappling with the concept that Hisham may not walk again, she came and she showed us functionality and optimism and joy and purpose, and how she had not rebuilt her life, but how she had continued living her life and repurposed her life, I would say. You know, so she is very much the woman who she was before, but with a more profounder purpose. And so I think just showing us that life is life, regardless of how you function, if you have the right attitude. I can't speak for Hisham because he's a very, very private person. But I think it was really important for him to see how life could continue. And I think he was inspired by that because, mm-hmm. you know, within 2 months of his injury, he was back at Brown, making a go at starting the semester again, just as he promised. Mm. So I think that the ability to keep on going, and the knowledge that years later these people have, who with spinal cord injury have wrought something wonderful for their lives, was the inspiration that I think he and I needed.
Yeah. Well, Hisham was injured while staying at your brother's house in Burlington.
At my mother's house, actually.
Oh, excuse me. Apologies.
No, okay. My mother moved in next door to my brother a few years after my brother moved back to Burlington. And so we have a little cluster of two houses. And so he always stays with my mother's house. And my mother's house, my mother was the
Your
one
mother, Marion.
Yes, Marion. She decided she wanted to make the house accessible for Hisham, because her house is Hisham's home base in the U.S. It's somewhere he's been coming ever since he was born, while living at her house in San Francisco. And every time, every summer, every Christmas, he's been in the U.S. It's been at my mother's house, whether when she was in California or when she moved to Burlington. Mm. And so she very quickly began to look at how to make the house accessible.
How has that gone? How has your family adapted this house to make it workable?
Well, we were very lucky for very many reasons. We've been so supported and given such grace. But in this case, we were very lucky because Representative Becca Balint came to visit Hisham at the Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital where he was at in Boston. And we were talking, the contractor, who is a friend of ours, who's actually working on the house accessibility issue right now. You can hear the noise in the background potentially. He and I were talking about the rather complicated plans that my mother was going to have for making that her house, which is kind of a, you know, 100 years old, accessible for him. And Becca said, well, I know of this Vermont-based company called Wheelpad, and they do this. And what they do is they create little tiny homes, kind of caravans, with different configurations. My son is a bedroom and a bathroom, and you just attach it to your home. Because it's on wheels or struts and not on the ground, it actually doesn't cover the green area. And so for Burlington, which has quite strict zoning laws, regulations, it didn't mean that it was going to be disqualified because it would be covering up the land proportionally. And so we got in contact with them, and over the summer we got one attached to the house, and Hisham has come and stayed in it. And it's transformational, because the houses in Vermont are not built for accessibility and are very difficult to adapt. So it was transformational without it being something that was so destructive and so complicated. As it was difficult for us to get the zoning permission. My mother did all of this. And so all of this is really as a result of my mother being ambitious and in her love for Hisham, and ambitious in what she thinks he deserves. And so she went to the design board and initially got turned down.
Why?
And then she went. I think because this was unprecedented, and I think the design board has a conservative approach to making decisions that would set precedents for zoning issues. I don't know enough about it. I wasn't involved in the process, but I do know that when she went back and did an appeal, the entire community went behind her. The local meeting house, the nearby synagogue, which is right across from the meeting house, the Quaker meeting house, and they both wrote letters of support. And the community wrote letters of support, and they all came to the meetings. So it was very clear to the design board that this was something that the community really celebrated and really thought was important and thought would be an addition to the neighborhood. So, and I think it's a really important precedent to have. When I was at Spalding and having talked to Becca Balint, I then talked to a lot of other patients on the ward, and none of them had heard of this company. And a lot of them were trying to grapple with what they were going to do to go back to their house. A lot of the people on the ward were older, often older men who had fallen, who had some type of, you know, injury, and they had a house that they wanted to go back to, but they needed to go back too quickly, and they didn't know what to do, and they didn't know if they could afford it, and so they were thinking about having to move. So having the wheel pad is this amazing ability to just quickly adapt your house to your new lifestyle, and for some people who might be able to improve their ability to move, you can then sell back the wheel pad, or, you know, give it back after renting it, so it doesn't have to be a permanent change to your house. So we were really lucky to hear about it when we did.
And it sounds, Elizabeth, like that your family has done so much hard work to turn this house into an accessible home again for your son. And it's really happening. That vision has come true. I wonder, though, how, and this might be a more a harder answer to pin down, but how has it been for your son, or for you and your family to readapt to Burlington and to Vermont as a home base after something so violent happened here?
That's a really interesting question. I can't speak for Hisham, but yeah. He has been back here, and he did spend 3 weeks here. I think the only negative thing about his time here was that he didn't have any friends his age. I think he was a bit bored. But I think this is a place that my family and I have been coming to, and my family here have been living for a long time. And I said at the time, and I still believe it, that it was a lightning strike from the National Weather System. We know that there is a larger acrimony, antipathy, dehumanization of Palestinians going on, and that will continue, and it will get worse. And I can see this happening as colleges particularly are adopting policies that will make it easier for them to restrict activism by students about the Palestinian about what's going on in Gaza and what's going on in the West Bank. And so I think, unfortunately, for my family, particularly my Palestinian family and my nuclear family, America is a less welcoming place as a Palestinian, as at a time where there should only be sympathy and compassion and action for the part of Palestinians. My daughter is currently registered and is attending a course on a Dublin university. And I have realized that it's only in Ireland, where she is actually a citizen, because I was born there, that she is seen as a human. In Palestine, she is a citizen, but she's not seen as a human. In America, she's a citizen and she's not seen as a human. In Ireland, the Irish look at Palestinians and say, yeah, we get you. We know what it's like to be occupied, and we know what it means to be denigrated in that way. And I think that's what is hardest for what happened, not the shooting of my son here, but the choice that someone made to shoot three young men because that they were Palestinian, and that was validated by a national, cultural and political attitude that means that Palestinians are not worthy and therefore are capable or you can kill them without actually being called out. I mean, as much as we're seeing happening in Gaza, there are 40,000 Palestinians who have been killed in Gaza that we know about, and a significant number of those are children. And so if that can happen without anyone actually taking action on that, then three young men being shot on a street, wherever it is in America, is totally permissible and is not currently being seen as a hate crime, even though it clearly was. So I think in general, it's the U.S. that is considered to be a place to be uncomfortable for my family, not Vermont. Burlington is a place where we have been welcomed, and everyone has taken action to be in contact with us afterwards and to give us support. I mean, Mary Catherine Stone, a local legislature from the Vermont legislature, was with us in the hospital, and luckily, wonderfully, coincides with her own interests, and she's working on getting tax credit, tax benefits, tax deductions for people who are trying to make their homes accessible, as well as understanding and making sure that when we were in Boston, that we were getting support. So in the community here is amazing. It's the national attitudes towards Palestinians that is incredibly dangerous. Mm.
Elizabeth Price, thank you so much for joining us today. And we all here at Vermont PIBLC wish for the ongoing recovery and good health of your son.
Thank you very much.
Joining us now is Edie Perkins of Burlington. She works for the Kelly Brush Foundation, which supports people with spinal cord injuries to lead active lives. And 7 years ago, Edie was in an accident and herself was paralyzed from the chest down. And she is here with us in studio today to share her own story. Edie, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're really glad to have you. And listeners, you can join the conversation as well. Our phone lines are not open today, but our email inbox is. Have you needed to modify your home to adapt to an injury or an illness? What are some of the common problems that you have come across in that process? Email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Now, Edie, as I understand it, prior to your injury, you were an avid runner and a cyclist. You did marathons. How did your sense of self and of identity change from before this injury to after? Or did it?
Well, that was one of the hardest things at first. I was in rehab for 4 months after my injury. And I think it felt like a very safe place because I didn't have to be confronted with those challenging questions of, you know, who would I hang out with? What would I do for fun? I used to spend all my free time out with friends, cycling or running and being outdoors and getting into the woods. And I knew that that would be different when I went home. So it was challenging at first and scary to think about it. However, I knew I was going to get back to being active. Being active is always a huge part of my life, and I knew it would go on. When I'd run marathons, I'd always seen people doing it in the race wheelchairs or hand cycles, so I knew it was possible, and that was the vision I had in my head. It was just a matter of how do I get there?
Oh, we just heard from Elizabeth Price, the mother of Hisham Awartani, who was telling us about that time when he was in rehab in Massachusetts. And that was this period when they were figuring out how they were going to change their house, change around his dorm room to figure out what life would look like moving forward. Was that also when you were starting to figure out what your plans would be?
Absolutely. Yes. When you're in rehab, occupational therapists and physical therapists work with you. They ask a lot of questions about what is your home like. They typically go to your house to see if the doors are wide enough and make recommendations for what kind of modifications you'll need to make. And of course, those modifications are on you. So there's no, there are nonprofits that help provide funding for those things, but typically you have to pay for that on your own and they can be very costly. Mm. But I lived in Los Angeles at the time of my injury, and luckily I had a one floor house that did need a ramp built to get into it, and I needed to completely redo a bathroom. But those were the only two things. Mm. Still, it comes with a hefty price tag.
I'm sure it does. Yeah. So you were living in Los Angeles, and then mm-hmm. a couple years ago moved to Vermont.
I did, yes.
What were some of the big differences that you noticed in terms of accessibility?
Well, LA is a newer city, and California has much stricter ADA requirements, or they're much stricter about how they implement them mm-hmm. because it's a lot newer. So,
and ADA, that's the federal law that yes. requires places to be accessible.
Yes, Americans with Disability Act. And so I would say in LA, buildings are much more accessible. Here, there are a lot older buildings, and it's a hillier, Burlington at least is a hillier city. Mm-hmm. So navigating the hills
and a snowier city.
Yeah. That's a challenge. There are buildings that you can't access because they have stairs. And a lot of the homes too are have a lot more steps to get into or tend to be multi-floor.
Mm. So when you moved here, did you know where you were going to live? Was that a challenge?
That was a challenge. Yeah. Yes, I spent a lot of time on Zillow looking around. And first I was looking for a furnished apartment. And so that dwindles your pool a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then to find one that was accessible was... I couldn't find any. So I ended up in an extended stay hotel, and then I lucked out and found an apartment in a building with an elevator. Mm. It wasn't set up for somebody in a wheelchair, so I quickly learned how to use toilets without bars next to them or get into the tub without the right equipment. Mm.
And that must have been a little scary because, as I understand it, you live alone, and that is something that's mm-hmm. very important to you and your identity.
Yeah.
So now, are you still living in that apartment?
No, I actually built a house in a development. So I worked, and typically those houses are very cookie cutter, but the builders had never built a house for somebody in a wheelchair and were very accommodating and let me work with an architect, Cleary Buckley, who has a spinal cord injury and is an architect here in town. So he helped with some of the designs so that it would be really dialed in for what I needed. And now that I have something that I was able to design, it's really wonderful. Mm,
that's great. What were some of the best features that just made life feel smoother?
Well, designing the bathroom is one, like mm-hmm. a shower that's easy to roll into and having enough space to navigate in the bathroom and to have a counter that you can wheel under and get to the sink easily. And similarly, the kitchen is... It's so nice to have a kitchen that works for me where I built it so there are a lot of open shelves. I don't have to open and close doors to get to the dishes and pots and pans. And everything's lower and easy to access. Mm.
And were these things that you already knew from your own experience that you wanted, or did the architect who specializes in this type of work, were they able to suggest things like, hey, you know, you might really want this type of cabinet?
Yeah, he had great suggestions. But they are also things that I knew I wanted after living in a house that wasn't set up for somebody in a wheelchair. There were things that were always frustrating, just sort of like navigating cabinets and having a dishwasher that's hard to open and close, those kinds of things I knew I wanted, but he was super helpful in coming up with ways to implement that, and he had great suggestions too. Mm.
Were there, and I ask this especially somebody who has moved from another state to Vermont, were there things that you you think the state or the town in which you live could do to have made this process of finding a home, building a home, more smooth, more accessible to a person who uses a wheelchair or has a different type of physical disability?
There's all sorts of blogs and things that you can find online, not necessarily in Vermont, but, you know, just things that you can find about, especially if you're building a house mm-hmm. from the ground up. Like, there's just a lot of ideas out there. But definitely there could be more information provided from a state or a city about how to find accessible housing. At least I never found it. It might be out there, but I never saw it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that says something. I'm sure mm-hmm. you looked too.
Yeah.
And so now that you are living in Vermont, a place that is very well known for folks' active lifestyles and being out in nature, have you found ways to bring that love of sport and activity back into your life here?
Absolutely. Vermont has so many ways to get out into nature, and there's some amazing adaptive sports programs, Vermont Adaptive, and then there's Green Mountain Adaptive Sports. There are places here in Burlington where you can get equipment and try different sports. So I think Vermont's done an incredible job and continues to do more to make the outdoors accessible for all.
Mm. Is there a sport that you haven't tried that you would like to?
There are plenty that I've tried that I'd like to do more of. I'd love to play more tennis. So that's something I'm starting to do. And then I'm trying to monoski. So that's something I've dabbled in, but haven't mastered. It's really hard to get it down. And I'm hoping that this will be the year that
this
happens.
The year.
Yes.
All right. We'll check back in with you in the spring yeah. and see if it happens. And then lastly, Edie, you have been on such a personal journey over the last 7 years. I'm wondering if you might have any words of advice or encouragement for folks like Hisham Awatani and his family who are closer to the beginning of, mm-hmm. of their own journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, it's so nice to hear how well Hisham is doing. I remember so vividly when that happened almost a year ago. So it's really nice to hear how far he's come. But definitely the Kelly Brush Foundation, I'm the executive director there. And a lot of the work we do is trying to make that journey from injury to independence easier. It's a really hard time and it can be very isolating. So one of my biggest recommendations and something that we at the foundation try to do is get people connected to peers. There's nothing like seeing other people doing things that you didn't think you could do as a motivator and a confidence builder and to get the encouragement to try new things. And it's also just such a great way to learn from one another how to navigate this world with a disability, because usually you have to figure stuff out on your own.
Hmm. Edie Perkins with the Kelly Brush Foundation, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thanks
for having me.
there are legal protections in place for people in Vermont who have disabilities, too. The first step is knowing your rights. Here to talk us through it is Big Hartman. They're the executive director of the Vermont Human Rights Commission. Their office fields complaints of discrimination, which often do involve housing. Big, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
We are also joined today by Rachel Batterson. She's the director of Vermont Legal Aid's House Discrimination Law Project. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Rachel, help us start off here by understanding Vermont's housing market for people who have disabilities or might need a special accommodation. I mean, we've all heard how crunched the housing market is generally, but what percentage of housing is up to ADA standards?
So, yeah, it's really hard for anyone to find housing right now, but particularly hard for Vermonters with disabilities. And that's because Vermont just doesn't have enough accessible housing. And also because people ignore, it's actually the Fair Housing Act, but yes, similar to the ADA, those laws that protect people and require certain features. So those laws that I'm talking about, in addition to the ADA, are federal and Vermont Fair Housing Acts, which are civil rights laws that protect people from discrimination, including people with disabilities. They apply to everyone, including towns and homeownership associations, mobile home parks, landlords, even neighbors. But many people either ignore or don't understand that they have fair housing duties, and especially in two important ways that make housing less accessible to Vermonters who have disabilities.
Mm, what are those?
The first is that some people discriminate against people with disabilities, and I would say especially people with mental health disabilities by refusing to rent to them. And that is a violation of fair housing laws. The second is that fair housing laws require everyone to agree to reasonable changes that a person with disability needs to accommodate their disability. That's kind of a mouthful, but for example, allowing a person to install a ramp so that they can get into their home, even if they normally wouldn't allow a structure in that location. A second one would be something like waiving a parking rule that generally a landlord has that says anyone can park anywhere, but because the person with disability has mobility difficulties, they give them a designated spot near the entrance so they don't have to walk across the entire parking lot. Mm.
So Big, then, go ahead.
I just was just going to say that the problem is that although people have these rights, they may not know, and the people that they're asking to make these changes either don't know or are ignoring those laws. Mm. So that just makes it really hard for people to find accessible housing. Mm.
And I'm guessing that's where both you and Big come in. Big, where exactly does the Vermont Human Rights Commission fit in? What work do you do to make sure people are aware of these rights?
Well, people who believe they have been discriminated against in housing or places of public accommodation or state employment can come and file a complaint of discrimination, and we will conduct an investigation. If we find that discrimination occurred, we also have the statutory power to file an enforcement action in Superior Court. Mm. We also try to play a role in educating the public about both rights and responsibilities under Vermont's Fair Housing and Public Accommodations Act.
So could you give us an example? I don't want you to disclose any private details about a client that you've worked with, but a general example of a case in which somebody might come to you asking for help or around these types of accommodations for a physical disability.
Okay, so with physical disabilities, we often will see cases involving people who are tenants and need to make a modification to their apartment or something in their building to have full access and the ability to enjoy those premises. And a lot, like Rachel said, a lot of landlords and owners aren't aware that they do have some obligations to permit those kinds of changes, which under the law we call reasonable modifications. Mm. So that's one type of case. And a lot of our cases also involve, I would say the majority of our cases involving people with disabilities in housing are more of the area of reasonable accommodations, which are generally changes in how things are done that are needed to afford a person with a disability equal opportunity to use or enjoy their dwelling. So accessible parking space, many cases we see involve permission to have an assistance animal in a building that may say no pets allowed or no dogs allowed, that type of thing.
And Rachel, what when somebody is requesting one of these accommodations, one of the concerns is, you know, whether or not it'll be given the green light, the okay, and then who pays for it? Is, especially with tenants, is it still on the shoulders of the person who is requesting the accommodation to pay for, say, a ramp to be installed into their apartment?
Sure. So that depends. In general, yes. When you make a physical change that costs money, it is the tenant who has to pay for that. For example, ramp, they'd have to pay to have that installed. The exception to that is a small number of, a small percentage of housing, which is where they receive federal funding for that. So subsidized housing that people think of.
And are either of you aware of funding that is available for people who might be coming to you needing help facilitating these types of accommodations, but then also don't have the funds to put them in place themselves? I can imagine it's a very expensive process from start to finish, from the permitting to construction, potentially hiring a lawyer as well. Rachel?
It is. And there are a couple of places that I know of. One is through the Vermont Center for Independent Living, VCIL, which has limited funds and they often run out, but they do have funds to help people with that. And I believe that one or more of the homeownership centers has similar funds to help homeowners who have they may own a home, but you know, they have very little cash flow. So they also need, they're low income, but they inherited a house, for example,
right,
and they need help.
And Big, I am curious to hear about how some of these, how you feel like these cases that you work on with the Vermont Human Rights Commission typically move through the court system. How quickly are they usually resolved? Or are these things that can get tied up for a long time?
Yes, they certainly can. And it is an extreme hardship for folks who are trying to get their basic rights under fair housing law to have to go through the legal process to have things made right. At the Human Rights Commission, we are trying to speed up our investigation process as much as we can, because our data from fiscal year 23 showed that folks were waiting an average of 650 days to have their case come to conclusion at our office. And that is too long for anyone to have to wait for a basic reasonable accommodation to be granted. We are trying to move those cases through more quickly, and often we are successful in helping facilitate conversations between a tenant and a landlord about granting a reasonable accommodation so that it doesn't have to go through an entire investigation or enforcement process. But once you're in the court systems, if you've made it through everything else at the HRC process and the Human Rights Commission is taking a case to court, it is, the same process that any other civil litigant has to go through, and it can take several years.
Several years, wow. And is the plaintiff in these cases the Human Rights Commission or the family or individual?
So individuals have the ability to bring lawsuits themselves. They do not have to go through the Human Rights Commission to assert their rights directly in court. But if the Human Rights Commission is filing an enforcement action, the Human Rights Commission is the plaintiff. And at that point, the person who had a complaint with us is considered the aggrieved party, who is entitled to relief if there's a successful lawsuit.
Mm. And let's talk for a moment here about zoning. I mean, we heard at the beginning of our hour talking to Elizabeth Price, the mother of Hisham Awatani, about the hurdles that their family had to go through in order to get the city of Burlington to okay the modular unit that they were going to use for Hisham, to have it attached to his grandmother's house. I wonder if you could speak to both of you could speak to some of the struggles that the folks you work with face when it comes to, you know, perhaps well-intentioned zoning laws that aren't quite keeping in mind the specific issues of your clients or the people you work with. Big, let's start with you.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you're bringing this question up today, because we do see a problem in how the zoning, the set of laws and rules around zoning in Vermont really don't take into account rights under the Fair Housing Act. And we are currently grappling with that in litigation with a municipality where a family was denied a variance for a disability-related change they made to the exterior of their property. And the town that did not grant the variance claims that the Human Rights Commission doesn't have jurisdiction to evaluate that denial of the variance because there's a set of laws about land use. And so it really should be a question that according to the town, it's a question that the environmental court has exclusive jurisdiction to hear. Mm. But of course, the environmental court is not tasked with enforcing the Fair Housing Act or interpreting it. That is solely within the realm of our civil courts, our superior and Supreme Court. Mm. So we're currently handling an appeal at the Vermont Supreme Court that has an oral argument in that question next week.
Oh, wow. All right. And Rachel, we have just about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I would say that often towns don't realize that the Fair Housing Act requires them to make a variance as an accommodation of a disability. It has to be reasonable. There are factors to consider when you consider reasonableness. But yeah, I'm closely following this case of the HRCs because I think that town is just completely wrong. The Federal Fair Housing Act clearly trumps any local ordinance or environmental laws too.
Mm. Rachel Batterson with Vermont Legal Aid and Big Hartman with the Vermont Human Rights Commission. Thanks to both of them for joining us today.